Well, a very good morning to every one of you. It's our joy and privilege to be here. I'm just very grateful that I have survived about 20 near-miss bicycle accidents this week. It's a dangerous place out there. And then I escape, I get down the side to our little cottage, and then about a million mosquitoes attack me. But apart from that, I'm going to say not another bad word about Minnesota Family Camp. It's been an amazing time, a very special time. I don't plan to say this, but can I say this? You know, as a Christian educator, especially the leader of a Bible college with a passion to train and release men and women into ministry, and a graduate school that is seeking to assist key leaders around the world, we now have students in about 48 nations around the world, which is remarkable. Listen to this carefully. Almost nothing, and maybe I could say absolutely nothing, encourages me more than what I see on this camp. To have young people coming to Camp Friends by the thousands is a remarkable thing, and by the way, it's both countercultural and it's not happening elsewhere. You might not know this, but in the last 12 months, on average, three Christian colleges around the nation have closed every month. About 40 a year are closing in our nation. They can't recruit students. Their churches are in decline. In fact, let me go further and say, in the last 10 years, the seminary population in the United States has decreased by 42%. It means that across the nation, only just over half the number of people across all of the denominations are being trained for ministry. And so you start to multiply that across the state, and then across multiple states, across regions, ultimately across 50 states. It means that statistically, the church is in trouble. And it appears as though the culture war is being lost. And it gets super discouraging until you come to Minnesota Family Camp. And you hear reports of the numbers of young people turning up are doubling. I just got a text late last night. We've got teams out all over the region, some in Wisconsin, some in Montana. And one of our VPs texted me, said, in one camp just in 1 week, over 70 young people had meaningful conversations that said, we want to find out more about how we can go to Bible college and enter the ministry. That's super encouraging to me. And by the way, the only denomination in the country that is growing is the Assemblies of God, and we're part of that. Your church might not have Assemblies of God on the front sign. It might be named something else. But friends, let me tell you, there's incredible value in belonging and serving and being a part of something that's bigger than yourselves and bigger than your church. And so for me, Minnesota, I'm getting preaching and I didn't mean to say this at all. But for me, Minnesota Family Camp is a huge encouragement. And I believe the future of the church is good because of what people like you have done faithfully over the years, and that we've got thousands of young people coming onto this camp. And by the way, it's happening in other states as well. North Dakota's camp is oversubscribed. I know that Montana is growing. I'm an encouraged educator, and I thank God that the prospect of a successful and growing number of people serving Jesus and studying and gaining good qualifications is a big one. Two more things before I read a text to you. First of all, Pastor Mark, it's just been an amazing week. Thank you for your friendship. Thank you for the friendship of Minnesota. We feel so, so blessed, and we appreciate the invite. Every time an invite comes, I think surely they've got other preachers out there and not have to have us back again. And then we feel overwhelmingly privileged, and it's been on our calendar for about a year, and it's just such a joy and a privilege. We love every minute. You are just the best people, and we love being with you. We're so grateful. Just to say that we'll be taking our books away with us today, but if you still want to get one of any of them that are there, we'll be at the back just for a few more minutes before we leave. I want to read a scripture that on the surface might seem a little bit out of place. We are July 4th. Happy July 4th, friends. We have one Welshman who serves on our team at Trinity, and we're insisting that he has to work today while everybody else has the day off. I'm very grateful that I'm not British, I'm South African, and so I can celebrate. And by the way, we are proud Americans, and most of you were born to it. We had to write the exams, so we feel doubly blessed to be Americans on July the 4th. But there's something, thank you very much. We feel welcome. We're glad to be here, and we fly a big flag for this nation wherever we go around the world. We love all that America stands for and what it holds dear. And we want to continue to bless this nation. And here's a text that might seem slightly out of place, but you'll understand it as I go into it over the next few minutes. It's found in Matthew chapter 23, and it's verse 37. Some of you would immediately recognize it. It's sometimes referred to as the lament of Jesus. Jesus, standing, looking across the ancient city in which God had put his name so many centuries before, he says this, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you kill the prophets and stone the messengers God has sent you. How many times I wanted to put my arm around you, around all your people, just as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing or you would not let me. And so your temple will be abandoned and empty." Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I've longed to gather you, but you would not. You would not let me. And this lament rings across the centuries, right down to the present day. I went to a very proud school in the city of Johannesburg. It had been built at the peak of empire. If you know anything in history of the expansion of the British Empire, there was a time where it was said that Victoria's empire, the sun, never set. It was true. In fact, over a third of the world's population came under British rule at one stage, long after America had thrown those shackles off, by the way. And as that empire expanded, so British ways and British traditions continued to expand. And in 1908, right at the peak, if you like, of the British Empire, under the rule of King Edward VII, my high school was built. In fact, it was called King Edward VII High School. I remember all the traditions that we had. We all had to wear uniforms, of course. It was very British in that way. But one of the most significant things about the school that I attended was that just about 7 or 8 years after it was founded, in fact, less than that, 6 years after it was founded, you will know that in 1914, the nations of the world went mad and they threw their young men at each other in a conflagration that had never taken place in all of human history, and the outbreak of what was called the Great War or the First World War. Do you know that in one battle over a period of weeks, 1 million young men died? It was one of the most cruel battles ever. It was the first time that all kinds of munitions were being experimented with. They dug into trenches. In fact, my own grandfather won a military medal during the First World War, which is only one below the Victoria Cross, and he did that for bravery as a stretcher bearer in the trenches. It was a cruel war. There was gas that was thrown across those trenches. Hundreds of young men died. And my school, King Edward VII High School in South Africa, per capita lost more young men in that war than any other school in the empire. And so it made a deep impression upon the school. And year after year, they would remember the young lives that had been lost. In fact, we had all kinds of places around the school where the names of those who had died were inscribed. We had a cenotaph in the middle of the quadrangle. And on that cenotaph, hundreds of names of young boys who had lost, who had gone off to war. They had left their mothers, some of them their young wives and brides and children. And thousands of them were killed in this awful war. As a result of that, November the 11th, which was the Armistice Day, if you know your history, that in 1918, on November the 11th, on the 11th hour of the 11th month, the enemies and the Allied forces came together and an armistice was signed, which in some ways was just a pause in hostilities until the horrible outbreak of the Second World War. But that day was always and continues to be celebrated. All across the former British world, you'll find towns and villages with cenotaphs. The royal family go out to the major one in Whitehall in London every year. But we would have a very significant Armistice Day service on the Sunday closest to November the 11th. It was compulsory. All of us had to attend school that day. We all got into our uniform. There was a brass band, there was a pipe band, and it was always a very moving day. I remember we would gather around in the upper corridors of the school, and we would pack out that quadrangle. And at a particular time, of course, they would start to read the scroll of Young Men Lost, and then a piper with the bagpipes. I don't know how much you like bagpipe music. I'm of Scottish descent, so I sort of try to be loyal and enjoy it as much as I can. But a piper would go down into the base of a stairwell, so it was about a three-story building, and the piper would go down, and at a given moment, there would be silence in the quadrangle, and you'd hear the piper bring in the drones. You'd hear the drones at the bottom of those stairs. It would seem to echo up and around the quadrangle, and then, of course, the chanter would come in, and he would play what was known as the lament. It was an incredibly moving piece of music. I still remember the hair on the back of my head standing up as he would hit those high notes and then go back, and you'd always hear the drones coming through in that mournful sound. It was really, really hard not to get super emotional, no matter how hard you tried not to, as you heard the piper play at the base of the stairs, the lament, remembering the lives of hundreds of young men who had died so needlessly in that awful war. And so from a very young age, I kind of had an insight to what the lament was. I knew the feeling. I knew the emotion. I understood that it was much more than just being sorry. I understood that it was much more than just being sad. It was kind of a tragic sense of needless loss that you're now giving expression to in your emotions. It's almost like a desperate feeling of why? Why did that have to happen? Why did that take place? It was so unnecessary, but it did happen. And now, in retrospect, there's this ache in the center of the human being that laments over what should not have been and what might not have been, but it happened. And as a result, there was great loss and there was massive sadness. That's really what a lament is. And now we find, nearly at the end of Jesus' ministry, he's coming back from Galilee down into Judea, stands probably at a vantage point because there's several overlooking the ancient city of Jerusalem. Some of you might have done that, stood on the great Mount of Olives and looked across the valley and seen that ancient city, place where God said, I'm going to put my name, place where God felt so deeply committed that year after year and decade after decade, he sent the prophets to warn them, to call them, to ask them to serve the living God. And Jesus now looks at this city, sees a religious order that has no real heart for God whatsoever, sees a temple that one day he knows is going to be emptied and pulled stone from stone. And Jesus, our beautiful Jesus, our precious Jesus, feels all the depth of human emotion that anyone could have. And he verbalizes it with this deep, deep lament. Oh, Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, I wanted it to be so different. It should have been different. If you had heeded the prophets, Jerusalem, this day would not come. Jerusalem, I long to gather you just like a hen would gather her chicks. And at the peak of this lament, this outpouring of deep sadness from the heart of the Son of God himself, comes these words, but you did not want it. You refused the opportunity. You spurned the moments. You killed the prophets. And you did my messengers great harm. Oh, Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem. I paused when I read that text. And as much as I try to understand its biblical context, I ask myself this question. I pray that Jesus never, never has to lament over me. I can't think of anything that would be worse than to hear the sad voice of my precious Jesus lamenting, saying, I wished it was different. I longed for it to be otherwise. Sent you opportunities and you spurned them. I don't want the lament of Jesus over me, over our churches, over anything that I get to do. I never want to hear what Jerusalem heard that day. So the obvious question is, so what do we need to do? What sort of choices and decisions do people like us in this room need to make in order to avoid ever finding ourselves on the receiving end of the lament of Jesus? And I've got several things, and some of them might just scratch a little bit, might get a little bit beneath the surface, but I need to say it, and I hope you'll receive it. Here's the first thing, friends. If you never, ever want to hear the lament of Jesus over your life or your family's life, the first thing I want to suggest is that we attempt to understand our history. We get perspective. We live with an understanding of time and space and why we're in the world. We take time to actually conceive the real idea that God placed us in His purpose, in His plan, in this world at this time and in this place. That we're not objects of chance. That it wasn't just because a mom and a dad sort of fell in love, or maybe worse, just had a one-night stand and nobody knew else what else took place. That we are not here by chance. We're here in the plans and the purposes of God. And it's important that as Christ-following people, we actually allow ourselves to deal with why we're here, what's happened, what's brought us here, what's taken place, and what is going on right now in my life and what has brought it about. Understanding our history. Of course, there are multiple layers to this. I think the first thing we've got to do is understand our personal history. All of us have a story. All of us have a family. Some of us have proud personal histories. We speak about those early settlers. We speak about homesteaders. We speak about brave forebears and great grandfathers and people who've done remarkable things. Other people don't have quite as good a story. But what's important for us is understand that we're here, and in our past, there has been a journey that people have taken. There have been values that have been passed down from generation to generation. And I need to understand who I am and why I'm here and what my heritage is, and take just a little bit of time to understand that and get a sense of belonging and a sense of space. My friends, if you have alcoholism in your family history, and you've taken the time to recognize that, courageously face it, might have been a grandparent, maybe a parent. Well, it would be stupid to take a drink. I don't know if it's a gene or it's in the DNA, but there seem to be some inclinations that take place. And if there's that kind of thing in the family, then I just need to say, it's enough. I'm going to break this thing. It's not going to continue through my generation. If there have been things that have hurt and bruised and broken and brought about disaster in families, I am going to be the one that will be a living, walking defiance and say, it might have happened in my past. I recognize what's taken place, but I've been born for a purpose and I'm here for a reason. And I'm going to break this thing. It will not continue generationally. Brothers, if there's been violence in your family history, you need to make a deep, conscious decision that you will never raise your hand against someone that you love. If there's been rage and brokenness, why not make the decision that you're going to let the grace of God so flow through your life, you're going to hear the prophet, and you're going to declare, this is not going to continue. Violence will no longer be a part of our family life. Brokenness will no longer take place. By contrast, some of you have got the most remarkable stories of faith-filled grandparents. Parents who sacrificed everything they knew how to give you a start and an opportunity. And I would hope today that the decision would be made at a personal level with this kind of heritage. I'm going to stand on those shoulders and I'm going to serve God faithfully, and everything in me is going to be committed to transfer this living faith to the next generation. That's why we understand who we are. What's brought us here? What are the tendencies and weaknesses and areas to watch out so that you never hear how I long to gather you, but you would not? What about our national history? There's so much misinformation, friends. Even around July 4th, there's massive disinformation. You've probably heard it again and again. Well, all of the founding fathers were just deists. They weren't really Christians. So we won't really have a Christian background. And so why should we have Christianity prominent in America today? Let's just level the playing field. Let's just allow everybody to come to the table. We've got to make sure that there is no interference of church and state. And we hear this argument plowed again and again and again and again. Friends, let me tell you, John Hancock was a passionate Christ-following believer who would be right at home on that front seat. In fact, it's estimated that easily a third of those founding fathers were people who honored Jesus and actually wrote about a commitment of their lives to their wonderful Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. And so one of the most misquoted things in our current society is the separation of church and state, and it's now used by the state to persecute the church. Actually, friends, that whole thing was written into our Constitution to protect faith, to protect the freedom of the church from the invasion of the state, to give us fundamental liberties and freedoms which are being eroded until people like us stand up and say, in Jesus' name, we are going to serve him come what may. And we understand our history. You see, the kingdom is not going to be served by people who worship God on Sunday and then become ignorant political ideologues with no context and no wisdom, spouting off some kind of position. We've got to be more thinking than that, friends. I read just yesterday a Christian writing, oh, it's so good that we now got alligators to eat the 60 million illegals in our country. I'm not talking about illegals or anything. I'm talking about nobody on God's earth deserves to be eaten by an alligator. And as caring Christians, we've got to get a perspective and be thinking and care. Let me give you an example. Carol and I grew up in South Africa. It was the era, as some of you might have remembered, of apartheid, which was a system of racial discrimination institutionalized in government. We were somewhat sheltered from it, and we didn't see all the bad and ugly side. But I can tell you from the time I went to first grade and all the way through, there was one name that constantly kept coming up. It was the name Nelson Mandela. And every time I heard that name, he was a terrorist, he was a murderer, he was a bad man, and he was evil. Every time. And when in 1984 it was announced that he would eventually emerge from 27 years of incarceration, many of us were terrified. We're letting a murderer loose on the streets. I remember as he made his way out of the prison in Cape Town, holding his wife's hand, and he called for peace. We were all amazed. But all I ever knew was this was a bad man. And then quite a few years ago, Carol and I were asked to speak at a very significant missions event in Cape Town. We had one free day, and we did what we'd always wanted to do, and that was we went to Robben Island, which was the little island just outside of Cape Town, out in Table Bay, where Nelson Mandela and his comrades were incarcerated for a very long time. It was a beautiful day. We loved it. I remember we got on the boat, we crossed the bay, we looked up beautiful Table Mountain. It's the most spectacular scenery you could ever imagine. We got off there at the little pier and we made our way up this little path to the entrance to the prison. And all of a sudden, I saw signs that I suddenly recalled from my childhood. And they grated. It was, if somebody had risen up and punched me in the face, it wouldn't have had a greater impact. They were signs that said, "Whites only." I said, whoever in their right mind would have done things like this? And instinctively, I knew that this was not going to be a good day. We made our way into the prison. We heard horrendous stories. Befriended a young man who was deemed a political prisoner just because he led a march asking for more textbooks in his school. Made our way down past the corridor where many of them had to spend days just smashing rocks, meaningless activity. And then we came to Nelson Mandela's cell. Carol and I paused, the group moved on. I don't know if you can still do it, but we made our way in. It's just a very bare mattress on the floor, open grate facing the Southern Ocean where the blasts from the deep Antarctic would come in. And we realized for 18 years this man had been there because of his ideal of human dignity and freedom. Kind of what we celebrate, July 4th. The rest of the day was traumatic. Eventually we got on that little boat, we made our way back. We sat down in a coffee shop in the Victoria and Albert harbor area. I think the poor waitress thought we were having a domestic. We couldn't look up, we couldn't talk. The moment I tried to verbalize something, my voice broke. I was crushed on the inside, and I had to reevaluate pretty much everything about my life. What I'd been taught. Who had cheated me? Who had lied to me? Who had misinformed me? And over time, it actually became the most healing and significant realignment of my life outside of giving my life to Jesus and being filled with His Spirit. And I'd ask you, friends, there is something profoundly evident in Scripture, and that is that as Christ-following people, we are good citizens. We pay our taxes. We pray for those in authority. And we live good lives. And we can only do that when we get a perspective of the journey that we've taken and we hear if the prophets have spoken. And we understand things without becoming rabid, angry ideologues. We're above that. We're above that. May we serve God with great dignity, understanding our history. By the way, there's another one, and I could spend a long time on this because this is part of the thing that fascinates my life, and we study around the world with our students, and that is to understand international history, global history. What's brought us to this point? What's really happening in Ukraine? What's going on in the realignment of nations? How do we understand what's taking place in places like Rwanda and still in Uganda? What are some of the histories that broke apart East Africa? Why has the Congo never emerged from a state of civil war since the early 60s and the Simba uprisings? I don't expect you to become an expert in history at all, but what I ask you to do, friends, is as our missionaries get committed and get involved, understand that they're going to needy places that have got long and deep histories, and they need our prayer, and they need our support, and they need our understanding, because it's much more complex than going and telling somebody they need Jesus. Some of these people have got centuries of bloodshed and hurt and bitterness that has run right the way through the history of their nation, and it's into those very complicated context that our missionaries get to serve. That's why we need to be thinking people and listen carefully and sensitively to the way in which God instructs us. I need you to know that being campers at Minnesota Family Camp advantages you dramatically over your neighbors. Why? Because you get to fellowship, you get to hear leaders from around the world, people challenge you in terms of your values and your core beliefs, they call you to faith and repentance. We are privileged above what we could hardly imagine. Is this a bit tough? I think it needs to be heard. And I'm calling you to understand your place in the world and become a phenomenal, wonderful, passionate witness to Jesus in the world in which we live. Here's another thought that I had, that not only do we attempt to understand our history, we determine to confront injustice. That's part of the whole redemptive work of Jesus. Something is so transformed inside of our lives. We develop a sensitivity. We become aware of what's going on around us in the world. We send missionaries. We get involved. We make sure that we do not allow systemic injustice to continue where we have a say and where we have an opportunity. Once again, we confront constantly injustice domestically. We face it in our families. We seek to be fair with our children. We ask God to give us wisdom, to raise them wisely, to be committed parents. That's what it is, friends, to be just and wise and committed. I'll say it again, and I'll say it with a passionate heart. God did not call you to have children and then be an absent parent. Those little ones came into the world in their vulnerability, and God called you to act fathers as priests in your homes. Mothers as carers and lovers, parents, ensuring that children are raised with righteous values and carefully and wisely and justly. I believe that we have to consistently face injustice in our own nation and in our own society. Be aware of it. Try to be sensitive to helping people who just need a start in life. That's why I love how many churches get involved in all kinds of local programs to assist people. I became aware a little while ago, we were buying a little townhouse, and it just seemed like it was going on and on and on, and it was just one form after another form, and I realized there'd been a banking crisis, and I complained to my banker, and she said, look, it's not us, it's the kind of legislation that's coming down. And so I started to do a little bit of reading and background. Do you know what? I came up with a thing called redlining. Don't know how many of you know about redlining. Probably helps us, considering the predominant complexion of people in this room. After the Second World War, people started to afford cars. You know what cars did? Cars allowed suburbs to develop. And so houses were built. They started to go out, eventually miles from the inner city. And people who were able to buy those houses. And they left many of the inner cities bereft. And then, of course, those houses grew in equity, and so we started to develop a bit of generational wealth, and we were able to negotiate mortgages. And the bankers soon became wise to the fact that some of the inner cities just didn't have good value in the houses that were now being left behind. Some of them were falling into disrepair. And so the bankers literally got out red pens, got maps of cities like the Twin Cities and others, and they drew big red lines around the inner cities. And every property, domestic or housing property, not commercial property, but every housing property inside those red lines, they deemed to have no equity. And so people who lived in those houses couldn't borrow money, couldn't move, couldn't give their children a better start in life. And in some ways, unwittingly, I think it's the law of unintended consequences. I don't think people are just being nasty or cruel or even racist. But you know what happened? Whole communities got condemned to poverty systemically. I didn't know a lot about that until we launched our Pack Your Bags program at Trinity. It's a one-year kind of pre-college, for college. It's the most exciting thing academically, nearly one of the most exciting things academically we've done. And we have amazing young people from all over the country come, and they do this year of your life, and they get some college credits, and they travel. And at the end of the first phase, which is a life skills phase, with careful mentoring and training, we actually teach young people it's not a good idea to text your way through your first job interview, and you know, some pretty basic life skills. And then we put them all in a van, and we drive them all the way across from North Dakota to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and they team up with a ministry there that is an outreach to homeless people. It's called City on a Hill, and they find people who serve. And as part of their training, our young people actually go through 24 hours of poverty simulation. It's carefully managed and it's all safe, but they actually live for 24 hours in cardboard boxes on the streets. The life transformation is unbelievable. Friends, their worldview grows. It's wonderful to hear them come back and say, I've got such compassion for people who I always thought were just losers. It was all their own fault. It was something that they chose, and now I realize that many of them had no choice, and we've now got a generation of young people who are compassionately committed to help poor people and to help those who are disadvantaged and to serve. That sounds like Jesus to me. And so I plead with you that you would never hear the lament of Jesus because you've lived your whole life insensitively with little care for those who desperately need help and need our love internationally. Justice and care, making sure that at a global level and internationally we confront injustice consistently. Our lives have been filled with that. We shared a story the other day about how we were given a beautiful resort. We turned it into a missionary training center, and part of the transfer of the title and the deeds, I got all kinds of paperwork, and I remember going through the paperwork, and in those days, they had a horrible act on the books in South Africa called the Group Areas Act, and it required that any property of this nature had separate entrances for people of different races, had separate toilet facilities for people of different races. Doesn't that just sound horrendous? I'd never had to confront that before. And here I am, I'm reading it in black and white, and everything inside of me boiled up. It was this deep, deep anger at injustice. I remember the tears began to flow. I thought if we have some precious students from Zambia or Zimbabwe or wherever else they come from, there's no way I'm going to expect them to go through a back door while all the others come through a front door, and I'm not providing a toilet down some long passage. Everybody gets to have everything we've got all at the same time. And this thing built inside of me, a kind of a rage, and I found myself eventually standing up with tears almost dripping off my chin, and I tore those documents up. And I remember the words going through my heart and mind. I eventually verbalized them. If this is civil disobedience in the name of Jesus, so be it. I'm not on my watch going to live with systemic injustice in the world. I want to represent Jesus and his love and his compassion and his care for poor people. I'm kind of sorry that when we should be setting off fireworks and having picnics and burgers and brats, I'm sort of going on like this. But I'm still speaking to my own heart about it. I'm still having to confront my reflection of Jesus into the world all of the time. One last thought. We not only confront injustice, and this is important, we reconcile what we believe and what we do. I don't know how many people have spoken to you about this, friends, but we are fearfully and we are wonderfully made, according to the Bible. We have the fingerprint of eternity on our souls. We are made in the image of the eternal God. There is something incredibly valuable about human beings, and there is no faith on the planet that places a higher value on the human life than those of us who are Christ-following people. That's why we believe in life before birth, and we believe in dignity at the end of life. That's why these things are all really important to us. Our virtue system, our value system, our morals. We try to teach this to students all of the time. And it's really important that because we are created in the image of God, we learn to join up in our lives, everything about us, so that we don't have this kind of segmented life that our society is encouraging us to live. So a very practical example is we don't go to church and go to work. We live. And whether it's work or church or play, it's all the same thing. We don't have these segmented secular and sacred divides. We are Christ followers 24/7. And it's a discipline to join that up, to be the same person. The Apostle Paul put it this way: I know what it is to have a whole lot. I know what it is to have very little. I know what it is to have steak on the plate, and I know what it is to go hungry. That's my paraphrase. And then he goes on and he says, I have learned in all circumstances to be content. Let me paraphrase that. It was saying every single time you meet me, you're going to meet the same person. I'm not going to throw temper. I'm not going to treat some people one way and other people the other way. You don't have to walk cautiously when you're in my company, because I am a Christ follower and his grace in me is sufficient, and I've learned in every circumstance therewith to be content. And we've got to join that all up in our lives. The first place it starts is in the quiet place. A constant daily prayer. Jesus, let your beauty be seen in me. Won't you so deal with my heart and my life? I pray this morning by morning, Lord, evening by evening, I ask that you would deal with my temperament, who I am, my hurts, and that I wouldn't relegate some things to a side room of my life, but that I would walk in grace and confidence and wholeness and healing. Some of you need to do that. And if you find that you've got sort of sketchy responses to little, if people find it easy to push your buttons, spend a bit more time in the quiet place asking God to make you happy with who he made you to be. I think the other place that we learn to do this is in the faith community. That's why we believe in church. That's why we believe in camp. There's something phenomenally important, friends, about the answerability that comes to our lives when we find ourselves in a committed community. Years ago, we had very precious friends. He was an orthopedic surgeon, very capable man. We stayed in their home several times, and during the course of our stays, every now and again, it would bleed out that they weren't always getting on that well with each other. We prayed with them. We encouraged them. Make your life good. Stay together. Raise your boys. And then an opportunity came for them to move on. Really good job. They left the church that had been kind and caring and loving. When they got to the new place they were going to live, they never found another church. I remember us praying earnestly for them. And it only takes a month, maybe two, that the inconvenience of getting up and going to church and getting committed and being answerable fell away. Eventually, 6 months later, they were in no Christian community at all. And in less than a year, their marriage was gone. What held their marriage together? Some real hard work, but I'll tell you what, friends, the care of a community that prayed with them and held them answerable and held them accountable. And I think Jesus would say, how often I longed to gather you, but you would not. The community. And of course, we need to be the same people all the time, making sure that what we believe and what we do is evident in the world. And my default at camp, which I could go in various different ways, but my default is that's why we do missions. That's why we send missionaries. That's why we have Joe Gordon. That's why we have a 5K run for Cairo. That's why we get behind all of these things. Why, friends? Because we're not going to talk some kind of talk and then not walk the walk. We're going to declare with our mouths that Jesus is Lord, and we're going to live it out in everything that we do through generosity and kindness and bringing together what we believe and what we do so that it brings honor and glory to Jesus. And by the way, it's so much more comfortable when we reconcile God's plan and purpose in our lives with who we are. So I never really do this, but let me say, I haven't intended to offend or hurt. I've just tried to encourage us to live lives that are honoring to Jesus. And I've asked you to find your place in the world. I've asked you to become a determined individual that refuses to let injustice prevail as long as you have anything to do with it, because you love Jesus and you fulfill his reflection in the world. And I've said, please let who you are and what you believe be the same thing. Somebody came to me yesterday, said, found a YouTube video. I didn't even know that I had YouTube videos up. And I told a story that dramatically changed Carol and my life, dramatically. We had started a school of missions, and as a very young professor with totally inadequate qualifications, I was teaching a missions course. Students ask the most unnecessary questions sometimes. And I developed a strategy which went something like this: that's a really good question. It's coming up in the next class. I shouldn't be letting these trade secrets out, should I? And I hardly had a lunch in that first year. I ran off, I got into the books, and I'd come back, and I think they thought I was more intelligent than I knew I was. I got about half a semester into this course, and I ran out of steam. I really did. I remember going in one morning. It was only a class of about 7 students. I said, sisters and brothers, I just want to let you know, I'm about done. I don't know if I can teach anymore. I've given you everything that I can. It was kind of missions 101. And in the literature at that time, there was a very strong amount of literature that spoke about people that were disrupted in their lives, like refugees or people moving into inner city or whatever it might be. People who were in transit in one way or another were very often most responsive to the gospel. We read that again and again. And I had heard, kind of through the Bush Telegraph, that about 20 miles from where we lived, there were people arriving from the civil war that was raging in Mozambique to our east, and that they were arriving and they were now in refugee camps. So I remember saying kind of naively to my students, hey, what do you say that instead of us having class tomorrow, we leave really early and we see if we can find these refugees? Let's see if what the books say is true, and we'll try and lead them to Jesus. Well, they were so happy not to have to be in the class the next day. They all said an enthusiastic yes. And so somebody had given us a beaten-out old van. I drove around. It was about 7 o'clock in the morning. They all piled in. we drove out, we went on the tar road, we went as far as I knew that we needed to go. We took a left going north up on a dirt road, drove for some distance. That road ran out, and I'm saying, you know, I think they should be around here somewhere. I don't know what I was looking for. I thought maybe long rows of white United Nations tents. I don't know what I was looking for, but I thought they should be around here somewhere. And eventually, we were literally driving between the bushes, red African soil, you know, piling up in great clouds of dust. And I can remember pretty much the second that it happened. I looked down to my left, and down a short slope was a lady sitting on the ground with three children, some sticks pulled together and tied together by a torn open plastic shopping bag. Get the picture? I was so stupid. I pulled that wheel round, I put my foot down, we went down that little slope, I hit the brakes, of course, we all disappeared in the dust, and we climbed out the vehicle. Must have been terrifying. How stupid was that? And I remember as we cleared the dust, I went over, here was this woman, she hadn't even noticed we had arrived. It was awkward. I reached out my hand, she didn't see my hand. I was only inches from her face. So I stood back and she stared at some spot, and her three kids did the same. It was just almost bizarre. I saw a young man walk on the path just a little higher up where we had been driving. I said, "Do you speak this lady's language?" He said, "I believe so." He spoke broken English. He came over. I said, "Please will you ask her just to tell us a little bit of her story, and we'll see if we can help." There was no emotion for the next 5 or 6 minutes, no emotion. She shared how she lived in central Mozambique, and in those days there were two opposing forces, and the one would move north and go through the village and pillage and rape, and then a few months later the others would gain some control, they'd come south and they'd do the same, pillage and rape. And her husband had been marched off to a war that he didn't know anything about and didn't want to fight anyway. She hadn't seen him for months, and eventually one day she determined, enough is enough, I'm going to finish here. And she had heard that there was a place that was safe if she followed the direction of the setting sun. So she took her four children and she headed out following the direction of the setting sun. She shared all of this through a translator, broken language. She said the second night, if you know the geography of that area, they had to pass through what's called the Kruger National Park, huge, big wilderness area. She said, "I gathered my children under a spreading acacia tree. And to her horror, as the sun was setting, she realized she was surrounded by a pack of hyenas." If you've heard a hyena in the bush, it's an eerie sound. She said, "I got a stick and beat the ground, but it didn't help." And then she shared how one of those larger hyenas had rushed forward and grabbed the baby off her breast and dragged her little one into the bush. Next day she got up with three of her children and continued to follow the direction of the setting sun. There was no place to welcome her, no big center. We were the first to make contact. We promised her we'd be back. We got in the vehicle. I looked back. We all had dust-covered faces, and you could see the tears running through the dust. We didn't speak the whole way back. I said, 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. They said, yes. We took some tarps, picks, shovel, and still with tears and broken hearts, we dug a pit latrine to give her some dignity. We took her food. I phoned a doctor friend. I said, "You've got a great practice, but I just need to tell you, you need to give it up and come and work with us." He did. We bought an old bank, a mobile bank. We ripped it out. We turned it into a mobile clinic. We started to attract nurses, several doctors. We started clinic work, most elementary, basic, sometimes called barefoot doctor work. I remember so clearly the first time that group came back from that mobile clinic, and They had a blood sample. They said, we think we know what's wrong. And it was the first time that we saw somebody carrying the HIV, AIDS virus, became a pandemic. We started home-based AIDS care programs. Our values, our lives, our priorities, our giving, everything about us changed and continue to impact us to this day. That's why we love serving key leaders across Africa. Why, friends? I'll tell you why. We found our place in the world. And there remains this deep, deep passion inside of our hearts that we will never, ever, ever, ever hear Jesus say, Paul, Paul, how often? But you would have none of it. I'm saying today, Jesus, I'll have all of it. And you can have all of me. And I'm going to navigate my way through life as a thinking, committed person with deep convictions so that I reflect Jesus in the world. Thank you for the awesome privilege of being able to open my heart to you today. Thank you for listening as intently as you have. And my prayer is that the good people who love Jesus in Minnesota will see life transformation in your communities. And dare I say, in your state, and that Jesus would be honored.